welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And our guest today is Michael W. Harkins. Mike is a friend whom I first met maybe 25 years ago when we both did work for the same regional magazine. Me as a freelance writer. And Mike, I think you were art director and editor at that point.
I was I was the creative director and the cover story writer.
Terrific. Mike has written books, including an important one called Move to Fire, which we'll talk about. In an earlier career, he worked in concert production for acts like Journey, Bruce Springsteen, Michael Jackson, which I think makes him our only guest to date with a gold record. And before that, he served with the U.S. Army's Elite 82nd Airborne Division, which makes him the perfect guest for this minute of the show. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here. It's a platinum album, Brian.
Well, platinum.
Wow.
Get your elements right.
Demoted in your first 40 seconds on the show. That's a new record,
Mr. Scientist.
I'll change my notes. Hal, what happens at this minute that makes a paratrooper such a good guest for us?
All right, here comes minute 58. Aboard the Stark Industries airplane, flak bursts illuminate the night sky as Peggy Carter shouts over the roar of the wind. You can't give me orders. Steve Rogers, gripping the open rear door, flashes a determined grin. The hell I can't. I'm a captain. He leaps into the darkness, flak exploding below. Peggy watches, her breath catching as his parachute blooms against the murky sky. Deep within the Hydra factory in Krausberg, Johann Schmidt and Dr. Arnim Zola stride along production lines, where futuristic weapons pulse with eerie blue light. Zola gestures to the machinery. As you can see, production of the Valkyrie is progressing on schedule, even with components of this size. Schmidt's eyes glint with ambition. Increase the output by 60% and see to it that our other facilities do the same. Zola hesitates, his voice cautious. But these prisoners, I'm not sure they have the strength. Then use up what strengths they have left, Doctor, Schmidt replies coldly. There are always more workers. A tall Hydra worker with a clipboard approaches Zola, but Zola waves him off sharply. Not now. In another part of the Hydra facility, members of the 107th, now haggard prisoners, are marched toward a cell block under the watchful eyes of Hydra guards.
Lovely, exciting minute. Mike, can you give us the broad strokes of your service with the 82nd? I think you'd want us to say up front that while you trained for combat and jumped out of many aircraft, you never actually dove into enemy territory under fire like Steve Rogers did.
That is correct. And in history, except for World War II, there have not been many, if any, I need to think about it for a second, jumps in which the troopers jumped into hostile fire. The philosophy of airborne is to be a shock troop, but the shock is in the quick insertion of troops into a place, but not necessarily a place that's a hot zone. I was in the last draft of the Vietnam era, and my number was 14 of 365. So I decided, well, I can wait for them to call me and say, come on in, you're in the Army and you're a shoemaker, you're driving a truck. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But I figured, well, if I'm going to go, I'm going to go and do what I want. And I had wanted to be a paratrooper since I was a kid. I also wanted to be a stuntman and an actor and a musician and all those things.
All the fun jobs.
Yeah. So I joined, and I am known as a Vietnam era vet. And I was in from June of 72 until almost August of 75. I extended my enlistment a couple of months. I came out as an E5, which is a sergeant. Although my rank, there are two E5, this is more than you need to know. There are two E5 ranks. One is sergeant, and that's the traditional three stripes you see on the sleeve. And the other one is called a Spec 5. Spec 4 is an E4, and it's that kind of shield-like design patch with an eagle in it. Spec 5 is a sergeant, but you haven't gone to NCO school, and that's not commissioned officer. I was just looking at some of my my stuff that survived the fire from my time in the Army. Spent all my time at Fort Bragg. Two or three weeks after I went into basic, they said that the no more draftees were going to NAM. 6 months after I was in, they said, the war is over. It was a different war is over statement than the most recent one. But I digress. I was assigned to the only, at the time, the only airborne armor division in the world. It was a 4th 68th Armor. So we jumped out of planes and we dumped our tanks out of planes also, all sorts of things. I spent my last couple of months from my job. Everybody has a job in the Army aside from anything else. So you can be infantry, you can be a shoemaker, you can be a truck driver. I was what was known as a ground surveillance radar operator. And that was essentially a Doppler radar system we would set up on the perimeter of a camp so that we would get shot first. And that would be the early warning of any enemies coming. Technically, it was supposed to be, we could see out about 10,000 meters with our radar setup. And so we would warn or engage first. And that was my gig. I know the stuff you really want to know is about how jumps work.
Yeah, I want to talk about training and you know, how many jumps you did. And you mentioned while we were preparing to have you as on a guest, you mentioned the sounds and smells that go along with training and with jumping out of a plane. So, yeah, tell us all about that.
Yeah, the smells. We'll get to the smells. So you go to basic training where you learn a lot, not just about yourself, but about all those Army things we all see. You also learn the math of the Army, which is training is 8 weeks long, but there's a 0 week. And that 0 week it's 9 weeks, but the 0 week doesn't really count. And then you usually go to what's called AIT, Advanced Infantry Training, which is your training to do your job when you're in the Army. Then you go to airborne school. And airborne school is 3 weeks long. Again, there's a 0 week, so it's 4 weeks long. It has not changed that much based on, I watched a lot of footage just so I wouldn't sound like a dope. And my memory is shot. I was in rock and roll. So I did my basic at Fort Polk, Louisiana in June and July. Gosh, what a vacation that was. And then unusually for the way it works, I went to airborne school before I went to my AIT training. And that was assigned to the 82nd Airborne. So you go through jump school, it's the 3 weeks of training is, first week is ground week. The second week is tower weeks. And I'll talk about that in a second because it seems to have changed. And then the third week is jump week. It's a lot of physical training. It's a lot of, in basic, you have the drill sergeants and they have the Smokey the Bear hats. They help you become a different person than when you leave than when you came in. In jump school, they're known as black hats. They wear black baseball caps. And they are we a family show? Because I have some.
Yes.
Yes,
we yeah, are. Let's
euphemisms are welcome. Mike. Yeah.
they're bad dudes. Now there are bad dudettes. Now it is a man and woman airborne school. And they have female black hats. And that first week you learn really the basics. You get up every morning and you run a couple of miles every morning. Back then, so we're talking for me, it's 72. I'm ancient. Back then you ran in a t-shirt, your OD pants, that's the green pants, the standard work outfit, and boots. Now I see the clips of people that are running in shorts and t-shirts and they have their running shoes on. Yeah.
Soft. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. So you wake up, you run, you do more pull-ups and chin-ups than you'll ever do in your life. Among the troopers are soldiers from all of the branches. So SEALs, The Air Force guys, who are called the Condos, I think. I'm not sure if that's the name. You're all together, and it's officers and enlisted men, but there are no rank shown on the officers. You get an idea of who they are. So it kind of evens out, and as you go through that first week, you learn basic form. You learn there are mock-ups of the fuselage that you jump out of. You learn how to do a PLF. It's called a parachute landing fall. So that you don't drive your shin bones up through your chest, all of these different things. In my time, the second week was called Tower Week, and that was because you would be strapped to a harness, and it was a 250-foot tower with four outliers at the top. You would be hoisted up there in a harness, and above you is a chute. It's deployed but not deployed. And so they pull you up there, and it was like an amusement ride. I'll digress for a second. In Chicago, a long time ago, there was an amusement park called Riverview, and it had that kind of ride. The difference was when you got to the top and it released, you came down on a cable with the chute above you, and it was cool.
The 39 World's Fair had one like that, too, in New York.
I remember ride. That. So Tower Week was the closest thing you could get to a jump. After leaving the plane. So they pull you up there and then it releases and you float down to 250 feet. But Tower Week is also where the first cut of people is made by the people themselves. And that's because part of the training is in what's called the 34-foot tower. 34-foot tower is a thing that you walk up the stairs to. It's a 34-foot tower. It replicates the door of the plane. And you get up there and you learn your form. You learn how to stand in the door. You learn how to jump 6 inches up and 36 inches out. You are attached to a cable. When you jump out, you're essentially falling for a few seconds. And that cable finally hits. And then it's about a 40, 50-yard trip down a zip line, essentially.
Oh, neat. Sounds like fun. End,
it is. So that's an interesting point. It's fun, but it's that height. It's a psychological burden for people afraid of heights because at 1,250 feet, when you jump out of a plane, there's nothing between you and the plane and the ground to give you any sense of height. So it's a different thing. But when you stand in that 34-foot tower and you look out the door, it's 3+ stories. You can see down there. You can see the perspective as you look down along the tower. That's where a lot of, back then it was guys. That's when the guys, you would, every now and then you'd have a couple and they just could not do it. They could not do it. Or they would do it in such sloppy fashion that essentially they couldn't do it. And then finally you reach your fifth week and each day is a jump. 5 jumps. One of those is supposed to be a night jump. Something I always wanted to do, but never got the chance. For some reason, all 5 of our jumps were day jumps. 3 of them called Hollywood jumps. I'll tell you what that is in a second. So each day you go through the process of how you get to the facility, where you get your chute, how you put your chute on, all the different checks you go through, how you get into the plane. And then you go up, you make that first jump, which is scary, but it's not as scary as the second or third jump. After those, at that fifth jump, when you land, this is my recollection. When you land, your jump wings ceremony, I think, is right there in the landing zone when you land. All of it is quite a rush. For a young man, a lot of us just found it fun. Early on when I first met my wife, Elizabeth, we were talking about those days and we were talking and I said, well, you know, and as a paratrooper, you get hazard pay. She said, well, how much? I said, back then, I'm pretty sure it was $55 extra a month or a week. I can't remember. and she was aghast because she said, you know, that's nothing. You would pay them $55 a month to let you jump. And it was true.
I don't think we've ever talked about this, but when I was in college, I parachuted 3 times just recreationally, and it was a rush. For me, the PLF, the parachute landing fall, was the hardest thing to learn. I drilled that like 100 times before I got it right to the instructor's satisfaction, because it's just, you need to kind of hit the ground and more or less collapse like a cardboard box so you don't, break your shin bones. And I landed flat on my face in the mud more times than I can count.
Well, at least you did it. Right?
Same
You
for
better
you?
to have
I
done
don't
it,
know.
and you don't limp. So,
No, I survived just fine. It was not a thing of beauty when I did it.
it. You know, nobody does it naturally. And I had been doing martial arts. I started in judo when I was in seventh grade. So the fall didn't bother me. And in that second week of training, you jump off of a 3 foot high platform. Then you eventually graduate up to a 12-foot platform and you jump off that. And that's about, you landed about the speed that you're falling when you're in a, when you've made a jump. It is an odd position. You're absolutely right. You keep your feet together. On my online zine, one of my earliest articles was about the parachute landing fall versus the superhero land on one leg, stick one leg out. I explained the physics of why that's a very bad idea, even for a superhero. Many people have a lot of problem with it. And the body position is such that you land your feet together, you land on the balls of your feet if you can. And then you kind of pivot and you make your body like a banana. So it's all well and good in that way because there's no wind. When you're out there for real later on in your years with your division, there are times when you fall on your face, your butt. I almost said your the other butt, your butt. Your it's just it, it's a matter of sometimes you get hurt and sometimes you don't. And so that's the jump school process. And those jumps out of the plane, those five jumps you make. At first jump, at least for me, is a rush. I don't want to get too detailed for y'all, but you go, you have a, it's called a stick. And the stick is a long line of troopers on either side of the plane waiting to go. You stand up and you're commanded for all of these. So the command is stand up, you stand up. Your static line is that essentially nylon rope that you hook to a cable in the plane, and it's what's going to extend, pull open your chute when you jump out. When it's time to go, there's a jump master on each side of the plane, and they have been looking out the door. They open the door, they actually stand outside, they look outside, they check around, make sure there are no missiles coming in, no train tracks where you're going to fall, no train come. And they give the okay. When you hit the drop zone, there's a green light, they say go. And in those early days, that final jump, each trooper gets to the door, hands off, and this happens very fast, hands off the static line to the jump master who pulls it out of the way. And then you stand in the door, and then the jump master would slap you on the butt and say, go, and you go outside. You hopefully have the right form. We'll talk about this in conjunction with the movie, your form as you go out the plane. In that first jump, it's just so overwhelming. And the overwhelming starts as soon as the plane takes off. Now we can talk about the smells and whatnot. The smell of fuel, jet fuel, prop fuel, is pervasive when you're on the tarmac waiting to go into the plane. When you're on the plane, it's still there, and now the plane is vibrating because this is not a United flight. So it's not like there's a nice insulated fuselage. It's noisy as hell, and you're sitting literally shoulder to shoulder with everybody. And it's not smooth. It's never smooth. Often it's more than one plane. And so turbulence caused by those planes, and I'm talking C-130s. The jet that we jumped out of back then was a C-141, eclipsed by these massive Galaxy planes now. And jumping out of the prop plane is different than jumping out of the jet, which is different than jumping off the side of a Huey, which I also did, or jumping out the back ramp of a Chinook. But it's moving up and down, and all of that, and it's hot. So, heat, bumpiness, sweat, nerves. If you've had a funky breakfast or lunch or whatever, all of this comes to bear, and you are given an airsick bag. But it's the airsick bag that if you use, you're also going to take with you out of the plane. No stewardess is coming along later to clean up your air sick bags. I had that happen to me once later on in my time. And so the word is go. All this stick of troopers shuffle towards the door, stand in the door, and they go. You have about 4 seconds of you're being buffeted. The plane moves at about 120 to 130 miles an hour. You, for training purposes, you would jump from 1,250 feet. In a battle jump, you could be as low as 750 feet.
Wow.
What happens there is it's the time you're in the air. From 1,250 feet, you have about 20 plus seconds. Once you're past the turbulence, once you've been buffeted and you've had a chance to, your chute's open, you had a chance to look up at it, make sure there's no holes in it other than the one that's supposed to be up there. For a few seconds, it's blissfully quiet. And you're just hanging around. You're looking around. You go, well, this isn't bad. And you have that. And then you go, oh, look, it's the ground. And it's coming up. And the look of the ground coming up at you is a lot like you see in the movies. As the camera's like, it's like, oh, look, that's, oh, my, oh, my. And then you have to get ready. And you hit it. And you're like, hey, I did it. So it's very cool. The second, third, maybe the fourth jumps are where you actually now are not overwhelmed. And you start to focus on different things and you get a little nervous. I will share with you that on my fourth jump, keep in mind the fourth jump, I mentioned the Hollywood jump before. Troopers jump with their lives attached to them. Sleeping bag, meal kits, stuff that you have for your job, all these different things. When you see clips of the modern paratrooper now, they look like big, overfed turtles waddling on their hind legs or this thing, because they have 50, 60 pounds of equipment in jump school. And on some jumps where you would have to jump to maintain your jump status during your time of service, you would do what's called a Hollywood jump, which is just your parachute and the emergency chute. No sleeping bag attached, no weapon. So your first three jumps in your jump week, those are Hollywood jumps. You have enough to sort out. But your fourth and fifth jumps are with a minimum of a sleeping bag attached under your emergency chute and a weapon attached. Now, in jump school, the weapon is not the M16. But again, we're talking my time. It's the olive drab canvas sleeve that a rifle would fit in, and inside it is a 2x4. So on my fourth jump, I had a bit of nerves as I approached the door in all this gear and I put myself in the door. Your position going out into the wind, you're in an object that's moving forward at 120 miles an hour and you're about to step out and go backward. If you didn't get up and out that 36 inches out, you want that 36 inches out to get into the prop blast and it will turn you and push you back. If you just kind of get lazy and step out, the blast catches you immediately. And what it does is what it did to me, throws you back against the side of the plane and you roll down the side of the plane until you clear the plane.
Oh my God.
And so I did that. I had like two rolls.
This is what your chute's unfurling, right?
Yeah, your chute is being pulled out. And the danger there is as you roll along like that, your risers get tangled, your chute doesn't open, and all sorts of stuff happens after that. I was like, it was okay. I was able to spin around and get out of it. And they could hear it in the plane because one of the guys with me on that jump said, did you hit the plane? Said, yeah. But I realized as I packed up my chute, rolled it up, put it in a bag, that somewhere along the line, I had lost my 2x4. Never to be seen again. And the fifth jump was okay. After that, you get assigned to the next few years of your life. And for me, it was E-2 Airborne. Those jumps are crazy because people are nuts and they're veterans. There are people who are all gung-ho. There are people like, oh, let's get this over with. And there are people, honestly, there are people who are drunk. There are people who are high. It's just such a nutty situation. Now, the context there, this is important. The context there is in my time in the 70s, the people in the army, in the armed forces, they had been drafted. Some went to Nam, some came back from Nam. They had gone in because of, like me, they had a low draft number or they wanted to join. Some joined because they wanted to join. So you had this mix of attitudes, and those attitudes percolated all the way through everything, including the jumps. That is a spewed out thing of how you get into jump school, what you do, and how you live your life for the next few years after that. You have to jump about every 3 months to maintain your jump status. The infantry, they jump every couple of weeks, those poor guys. The armor division that I was attached to, tankers are nuts anyway. And so there, it was a party. You can't, you know, it was not a highly disciplined thing. It was a really good time. How we managed not to be killed or paralyzed during all those times is amazing, but it was an awful lot of fun. And I'm glad I did it. And people can call me Sarge. Who would have known if you would have told somebody in high school that little skinny guy, Mike Harkins, he's not ever going to amount to nothing. If you would have told them that someday somebody would call me Sarge, they just would have laughed at you.
You made
So, with
reference
all
to,
of that,
yeah.
I leave it to you now.
Oh, I was going to say, you made references in passing. You had some comments about Captain America's form coming out of the plane. What did you make of the skydive in the movie?
Well, again, I did a little research, and not surprisingly, considering the amount of money and effort that goes into those films, and it's a great film. His form going out the door after he tosses off that great line, "I'm a captain." His form was to, it looks like he bent his knees a little bit and then just kind of leans and falls out the door. That is how they first troopers were trained to jump out of a plane, was kind of that form. The Russians, actually, I think in the late 30s, experimented with having paratroopers, this is the truth, crawl onto the top of the wing as the plane was going along in the air, flying along, and then let go. That always didn't work out well. And so during the 40s, jumps in World War II, and for a while after that he had in the movie, just kind of bend a little bit and then just kind of fall out, was the form they use. So that was impressive. I'll jump ahead for a second and say in the next movie, Winter Soldier, there's a scene where he jumps off the tailgate of I think it's a C-130, and they're at very high altitude, and his form off of that is totally different, and it's totally correct. And we could talk
Wow.
about that anytime you want. So his form was good. The movie part of it is as she's watching, she didn't go to the door. As she's watching out, she's watching from the plane and looking out the door, and we see his chute open. There's a physics thing there, and that one object, an object leaves and they're both going at the same time, but they're really not. And when she looks out, she can see his chute open, and then he drifts away. In a real jump, once you're out in that slipstream, you are gone. So the only way she would have been able to see him, and the only way we would have been able to see him, would be for us to stick our head out and look. So that was the only funky thing. But his form going out, that was good. It wasn't nearly noisy enough. We know why that is. But the vibration and the sounds that are happening there are just, it's amazing. And so that also in the movie is, yeah, that's, it's more movie than realism. And you don't have to put yourself in the situation to realize if you're in a plane, if you're in a prop plane and it's going along at 130 miles an hour and it's this big ass, sorry, big butt tube of metal and there's no insulation, it's vibrating. When you're up in the sky and then somebody opens the door of the plane, the noise is incredible because the wind is rushing and the props are blowing. It's just like, it's
And
just
they're also
incredible.
shooting at you.
Well, that would be the thing. The 173rd, was the Airborne Division in Nam that were the next to the Special Forces. They were the baddest, the real deal during the Vietnam War. I believe the 173rd made one combat jump in Vietnam and it didn't go well. And they were shot at as they were coming down. That's where the shift, I think, it contributed in part to the shift of we're not going to have our guys and girls go out in the middle of a fire zone. We're going to put them in there, but we're going to put them in there at night, or we're going to put them in a landing zone that's not a hot zone right now, that sort of thing. The scene that you brought me in to talk about was impressively okay. How's that?
The thing that always bothers me in this scene is where did Steve get the training? Because I don't think they were covering parachute jumping at Camp Lehigh, because that seemed more like basic. And then I don't know if all the chorus girls at Radio City could teach him how to strap and pack and all that. So, but I guess he's a quick learner. Maybe he just picked up a Reader's Digest article on it. So, oh, this is how you do
Yeah, different movie.
Right, a different movie altogether. Mike, it was
Yeah, that's
really
right. He
interesting.
didn't. I for, yeah. He did not go through any sort of training they showed. You're right. I maybe natural flying ability.
That could be. I was just saying, it was interesting you pointing out the physics of him, how he would have just been gone. And we could chip at that just a little bit and say, well, it's a Beech-18, it's going to be going a little bit slower and whatever else, but not enough to make a difference. So that was an excellent point. And I would call out too that he's not on a static line here. So he's diving and then he's presumably pulling his own ripcord. I would suspect, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that means the parachute's going to open even just a little bit later. Which makes it all the less plausible that she could have seen him. He would have been even further away when the chute opened.
Is it also possible that Howard just hit left rudder immediately after he jumped out of the plane and we're just looking out sideways? I don't
I suppose that's possible, although I think she would have been tossed around the fuselage and
Yeah,
stuff.
that's right. She would have been. No, she's all
And
that
yeah,
alone.
in free fall, he would have had to wait until he had assumed a stable position and then pulled his ripcord. And yes, it would have been much farther. The rate that you fall, so terminal velocity of a skydiver, of an object, is 120 miles an hour. So if you jump out of a plane, you fall straight down. You hit 120 miles an hour. The formula I think they told us was in 4 seconds, you drop 250 feet. I think that's what it was. There's a slight difference in that, again, when you're jumping out and you hit the prop wash, you're pulled back. And so I don't think you drop that 250 feet exactly. But yeah, he would have been much farther away from the plane when he pulled the ripcord, I think. That little thing about in Winter Soldier when he jumps off the ramp at the back of the plane, that is used sometimes to deploy troops, but mostly a ramp jump like that is done by the Special Forces Rangers or SEALs, and it's called a HALO, high altitude, low opening, where they a platoon or not a company usually, but a platoon of a half a dozen or so, or a dozen special forces or troopers will walk to the back of the plane, stand on the ramp, and from anywhere from 10,000 to 30,000 feet, they will go off and free fall and not open until 1,000 feet or so
Or, and unless you're
from.
Captain America, in which case you do it without a parachute and just
Yes,
go into the
yes.
water.
Yeah, that was really funny. Did he have a chute on? Nah.
Nah.
And their form when they go off that, when you watch that scene in the movie, that is exactly how it looks for most HALO jumps when they leave. It's kind of a skydiving position they assume, and then just kind of fall off the rear. The wind has them turn in the air, and then they stabilize, and off they go. I never did a HALO jump. There are a few things a lot of us wanted to do. A HALO jump, because jumping from 20,000, 30,000 feet, you're going to free fall for a minute or so almost. The other one was Skyhook, which has nothing to do with any of us. But Skyhook is the most people know now from the one of the Batman films, where the C-130 comes over. It's got a hook literally in the front at the nose. You send up a balloon with a long ass cable, sorry, a long butt cable attached to it. And the C-130 comes along and snatches it, and you go from 0 to 120 miles an hour right from the ground.
No, we were doing that. That's the James Bond minute, I think we'd be doing on that one.
Yeah. Oh,
Right. Well, both
cool.
James Bond and
Yeah,
Batman.
James
Yeah.
Bond.
Right at the end of Thunderball and then in what,
Yes.
The Dark Knight.
Yep.
Yeah, you see that.
Never got to do that. I always wanted to. So once again, sorry, Brian can tell you this. I have a way of taking side roads and digressions.
That's our podcast. That's what we do
Yes.
here.
This is nothing but a digression.
It's our mission statement. Yeah.
Wow. Well, can we go into how you wound up from jumping in, out of planes to proximity to Bruce
I love you, smart guys. Your
Springsteen?
proximity to Mr. Springsteen. How did that occur? I came out of the Army and immediately went to art school on a GI Bill. Whilst in art school, between my first year and the second year of art school, I was also an actor in high school. During that summer, I got a job. This all honestly, this will bring us to Springsteen. I got a job as a performer at the first Marriott's Great America, which was in Gurnee, Illinois. During that summer, I was introduced to this band named Journey, who had their first album out in 74, 75 by a friend of mine. The guy used to be the drummer in a band that I had. And he said, "You have to listen to this band. It's amazing." And I did. The music resonated with me in ways that other music really hadn't. And through a series of consequences and a phone call that I made after great research, I was able to meet the band and their road manager at the Waukegan Ice Arena, a Quonset hut of an ice arena that held, three people. No, it's about 200, 300 people. They were playing a show there. I got to know them because I was in art school. I painted a poster. I met the band. So all that fan stuff. And then they were playing in Milwaukee, which is a suburb of Illinois. They hate it. The night, 2 nights later, and the road manager invited me. Just come and do that. And so I did that. And after the show there, their road crew was three people. And after the show, instead of standing around gawking at things, I helped them load the truck. Because that's the kind of guy I was at the time. I hadn't gone through college. My college was the Army, and I just had a different attitude about things. And that impressed, his name was Bubba, and impressed Bubba enough that he said, "You know, anytime you come to the Midwest, we'll give you a call if you want to come out and hang with us. You can, I can't pay you anything, but you can sleep on the floor in one of the hotel rooms." And then he would give us $100 at the end of a few weeks as they toured the Midwest. And we were the, and the we is a guy I went through high school with, a really good friend who I'll call Gonzo because that's what we called him. He and I went into the industry together. So we officially were asked to become, part of the Journey family and be roadies for Journey in 70, late 76, early 77. I came in and Gonzo and I did merchandise. But but 5 years later, the merchandise we were doing, instead of having a rider rental truck, we were one of five semis, and our semi was filled with merchandise. And we had done $40 million in gross sales over those 5 years of merch.
That's a lot of t-shirts.
T-shirts and they were, now you buy a t-shirt, it's $75. Back then, t-shirts were $8 and jerseys were 12, and there were programs and stuff. The change in these years is amazing. As Journey became very successful, they formed their own production company to do staging, lights, sound, and video for other bands of their peers, essentially. And I had been a film photography and animation major in art school. That second year of art school was cut short. I dropped out to go on a road with the band. Everybody told me I was nuts, and I was, but that was besides the point. And this production company, one day, their director, Paulie had heard I'd been in school. I was a film major, whatever. And we needed camera people. And he said, after you load in your merchandise and you chase all the bootleggers away, that was my job.
You were the muscle.
And yeah, little muscle. But I was fast and I had attitude. He said, can you come in and run camera in the pit? And I said, sure. And from that point on, at some Journey takes a break in 82, and they just shifted me, and I started running camera for the live concert video on the big screens, which is ubiquitous. You see it now. But back then, Journey was the only American company doing that. So we did concert videos, and that included the great bands. I was very lucky. I'm really appreciative of the time. But it was Springsteen, Prince,
Richie
obviously Journey
Santana, I
About the
think.
Dead, Julio Iglesias, Willie Nelson. And so I have stories about all of that. This is an hour-long podcast, and so I can't tell them all. The Springsteen thing is, we did a month of the Born in the USA tour. And what did David Letterman used to call this? His brush with greatness. We were in the Meadowlands Arena, holds like 30,000 people. And we were doing sound check. It was completely empty except for people who need to be there, the road crew on stage. We were setting up cameras. My camera was a house camera. So I was on a platform close to the house mixer in the middle of the arena. And for every sound check, I don't know if he still does it now, but Springsteen would leave the band as it played, and he would walk around the entire venue to hear how it sounds. On his way back from the very back of the arena, he was coming up the middle aisle there, and I was very close to that. And we're the only two humans on the floor. So he could have just kept on walking, but he glanced over and I waved, and he turned and he came over to the platform and he stuck out his hand. I took his hand and I shook it, and he said, I just want to thank you for all the work you're doing. And I said, I just want to thank you for all the shows you're doing. And he smiled and walked away. And I saw him a few times after that. That's how I came to be in the presence of Springsteen. But let me share this with you. We did some police shows, and those shows included, there was a Showtime. I don't know if you guys remember Showtime,
Oh, sure.
HBO Showtime. There was a Showtime special that they did on the police, and it was a concert from Atlanta. It was the concert when it was released on DVD, or when it was broadcast. I'm sorry, I can't remember which. It was eventually nominated for a Grammy for long form video, as was a Prince show that we did the same year in Syracuse that was broadcast live to Japan. And it's from that show. Whenever there's something about the police, there are a lot of clips about it. So last night on 60 Minutes, they were doing a thing with God, because I need his name, it just went out of my head.
Sting? Or...
No, Stewart,
Oh, Stuart. Okay. Copeland.
the
Copeland, yeah.
drummer. And to intro the piece, they showed some snippets from that show, and three of my shots appeared on 60 Minutes. And so I'm sorry that I'm even talking to you guys. I have so much
Well,
stuff to do. My
immortality.
public awaits.
Just watch the
Do
checks
what?
roll in.
Wow.
Before we
Yeah,
close,
yes.
And
we're
Mike,
doing
I've got to say, Brian, we've got to have Mike back. He's got too many
Oh, yeah.
stories in him. We've got to drain
Oh.
him of stories.
He's got a Michael Jackson story that'll take 15 minutes. We're not going to tell it today, but
Yeah, it was Michael
he's a
Jackson's
raconteur.
barbecue in Japan and Australia.
Yeah. Mike, I want to give you a chance before we close to talk about your books. Let's start with Move to Fire. Can you give me the elevator pitch on Move to Fire?
Thank you for this, by the way. And sorry, if I were sober, I wouldn't be as long-winded. Move to Fire is a nonfiction narrative about a little boy accidentally shot by a defective handgun, and the attorney who comes into his life 10 years later and secures a historic, still to this day, the only civil judgment for a product liability defect, civil suit against gun manufacturer. For like 25 mil, I think. And it's a story about trauma, tragedy, and what it takes to actually achieve victory against a corrupt, soulless, non-ethical entity. Man, how was that? And I'm lucky enough to have it optioned as an indie feature. We're in our 10th year.
Yes, you are.
Any day now.
Because no film is harder to make than a film about a paralyzed kid by a gun and an attorney. It's that simple.
Wonderful work of investigative journalism. It's just so detailed and has a narrative that pulls you right through the story. If what Mike said sounds interesting to you, I'd say you want to read Move to Fire. Good stuff.
I appreciate it, Brian.
And then you've also got this whole side gig is too light a word for it. You do consulting and communications. You've got a book out called The Way to Communicate. You got one out called The Way to Begin about getting your creativity kickstarted. What am I missing?
Isn't that enough?
Yeah, it's plenty. It's plenty. But where can we find you online? Send people to your website.
Find me. I have a bazillion domains, but the main one is michaelwharkins.com.
We'll have a link on our page right there. So, make sure.
That has my books, my piece about Steve Jobs, and my titles. There is thewaytobegin.com, which is a method for new writers who are having trouble starting. Waytobegin.com, movedfire.com, of course, and michaelwharkins.com.
And I'm going to take a personal minute here and say, you mentioned fire at the very beginning of our conversation. Mike lost his home in the same 2017 Northern California wildfire that I did. And in fact, I interviewed him for my book called The Fire Story. And his story, which we're not going to talk about today because we're out of time, was either one of the bravest or stupidest I heard in those days, maybe both. So if we can have you back, maybe we'll hit the fire story. But
great tease there, Brian. That was nice.
Mike was a hero that night, and he stayed and rebuilt. I stayed and rebuilt, and we get together for lunch once in a while. So it's an honor to have you on the podcast, my friend.
I'm really appreciative of being here, and you guys are entertaining and knowledgeable. It's nice. Knowledgeable is it's a thing in short supply in this day and age. So I appreciate people just like you guys.
Wow. Thanks for the review.
Much appreciated, Mike. And thanks for being a part of this. I'd also like to thank our audience for being a part of this. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we are always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com. for the latest about our podcast, topics, and guests like Mike. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute. I'll get it right.
I'm not
someday.
The only one drunk on this podcast, am I?
I can do this all day.